It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Morning.
I guess I got to fire up those mics.
Yeah, you got to turn on the
microphone. That helps a lot.
It's better if you just, like, if you just yell really loud. Hear it through my mic. So, well, fairly busy week news-wise, lots of different things, but...
Yeah, how about those hurricanes?
if we
get them until January, maybe then somebody will actually talk about global warming.
Yeah, it's amazing how that doesn't seem to factor into any of the coverage. So let's talk about the elections that we just had on Tuesday. Did all your votes turn out okay?
I don't know. I don't know whether they got counted or not.
I had to redo my ballot, actually. I hate those little fill-in-the-bubble ballots, and I was having a hard morning where it was hard for me to see and read, and I marked the wrong bubble on one of the races. I had to go back and get a new one. It was interesting. It's the first time that's ever happened to me.
And what do you prefer beyond the bubbles?
Well, I liked the old punch cards. I didn't have any problem with them.
All right.
Yeah, I actually liked them too. Although you would not think it would be that hard to count them, but I guess it is. So,
all right. So, a bunch of races turned out as predicted, but a couple of them are pretty tight.
A couple of them are pretty tight, and some of them had kind of interesting subplots to them. In particular, I think the Attorney General's race where Deborah Senn beat Mark Zidrin, and the sort of general consensus on that, I think, is that the enormous amount of money that were poured into those anti-Senn ads really rebounded against rebounded against Mark Zidrin, that it may have wound up helping Deborah Senn. Although,
I have to say, I think Mark Zidrin's whole campaign I don't have an agenda was a pretty stupid one, because I think people look at that and they go, a man without a plan. That's good. I mean, that was my response to it.
Well, and not only that, but it was a specific response to Seattle voters remembering what his record was in Seattle, but that doesn't mean anything to the rest of the state.
I know. So and they would have looked at that and said, what?
Yeah.
A man without a plan. Huh?
Yeah. Although, and the other thing is that the purpose of those ads was not so much, you know, it was a win-win for the Republican sponsors of those ads. Either they could help Zidrin, who they regarded as a less formidable candidate in the general election because he had not run statewide before, or they helped soften Senn up for the general. So they're basically have just gotten their licks in ahead of time for what we'll be seeing a lot more of over the next couple months with Rob McKenna running against him.
Right.
Against her, rather.
Do you think they're ever going to really find out the true source? I mean, the $1.5 million coming from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, do you think it's going to go any farther than that? And actually,
I don't think that there's any
probably
legal
not.
Way it can.
No.
The U.S. Chamber of Commerce could get some pressure to tell which industry the money came from, but I don't think they're going to. So I don't think we'll ever know.
Though, also, it's considered a moot point at this point,
yeah.
because the election's already taken place and Senn won.
All right. Although I hear there's still some votes trickling in, but yeah, it looks she's got like a lead of 10,000 votes right
now.
Yeah,
she does, and she's won in what was a pretty close race, and then it looks like Helen Summers has won also in the race against Alice Wool, which is a shame. And I think there also, you know, it's always hard to run against an incumbent, but Alice got so much negative publicity off of all the money that came in from SEIU. For that race, that I can't help but think that helped work against her in the long run, also. So that was a sad thing to see that she didn't quite make it in that race.
Yeah, but the negative publicity primarily coming from places like, you know, the two local dailies and stuff, which are not big supporters of any union.
Well, know? No, you wouldn't have expected them to endorse Alice Wolt anyway, but I do think it's a charge that carries some resonance. That people see that and see, aha, special interests are trying to elect one of their own. And for people who don't follow the state legislature closely and don't know what the issues are, don't know what Helen Summers' record is, for instance, or that she was getting a lot of big business money coming in also. She was also getting a lot of out-of-district money in that race, which was not highlighted in any of those articles. I think that worked against Alice.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So, and then jumping to what we can now expect on the November ballot.
Yeah, this is very very reminiscent of a couple of years ago when the district election just sort of snuck in with a court decision on the week of the primary for the November election. And we had another one of those decisions this year with the monorail recall is going to be on the November ballot. And for a number of reasons, even though, you know, I agree with all of the arguments of the recall backers of why the monorail is in trouble right now, but I think that the monorail recall is a bad idea. You know, in many ways it's a function of, you know, most of the problems that the monorail faces right now are things that we knew were likely going ahead of time when we voted on it in the first place, and the precedent that would be set by having a vote against something once it's already underway. And it's like, you know, how many times do we need to vote on this thing anyway? We've already voted on it 3 times. I don't know how many minds are going to get changed at this point anyway. But, you know, it's like the opposition to the monorail seems to have a hard time reconciling itself to the idea that this thing is going to happen. It may not happen in a way that is beneficial to taxpayers. It may have a lot of problems attached to it with the public-private partnership and the one-track rail and the technical problems that it's facing. But, you know, the property is already starting to be purchased for this thing. A lot of the planning is already underway. A lot of money has already been spent. And to stop it at this point, I think, would just set a very, very bad precedent for any kind of public works project in the future that has any kind of public opposition at all.
And the speaking of campaigns that were funded primarily from one source, that the recall vote, of course, being primarily funded by Martin Selig.
Yeah, yeah. Who
like
is
90% of the
who
money?
Who is, you know, probably hoping to snap up some of that cheap bargain property that would be left loose.
The city would have to turn around and sell
exactly
if the monorail recall initiative passed.
Right. Yeah. So either goes towards him or
yeah, maybe they can, you know, sell it to a new Seattle Commons and we can vote on that again too.
Twice.
Yeah.
No, that'd be 3 times actually.
3 times.
The Commons.
Yeah.
So. All right. Anything else on the elections?
I think that's enough for now.
Yeah, let's move on.
We got a busy week.
All right. Then a lot of international news, jumping over to Russia and Vladimir Putin, catching some flack from our own GW.
Although not very much and not very quickly. I think it took GW's advisors a while to let him know that something had actually happened in Russia and that the idea that removing democracy from the system is something that he should actually be opposed to, in theory.
I think George Bush's initial response probably to the idea that Vladimir Putin would take control of appointing governors to the various Russian provinces was, that's a good idea.
Yeah, I should try that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and not only appointing the governors to the various provinces, but also taking the half of the lower house of parliament that is... That was set aside for direct elections and taking that off onto party lists also, so that will no longer be elected by direct elections.
Saying that you can't vote for a member of the legislature here in the U.S. You couldn't vote for somebody for the U.S. House of Representatives or the Senate because the parties were just going to proportion those out.
Yeah, and in this case in particular, that the president, in this case Putin, very much has control of the system by which those party lists are being elected. That's something, along with the appointment of governors, that he has already been taking a number of steps toward trying to control over the past several years. It's a really severe backward step in terms of democracy in Russia, and it's something that I guess both Gorbachev and Yeltsin have now come out against in Russia itself, which is pretty unprecedented. They've pretty much kept their own counsel over the past few years on Putin's record. But above and beyond that, it's also very reminiscent of what happened here after 9/11, because the rationale that Putin was using for this was, well, we needed to fight the war against terror, against the Chechen rebels, because of the the school siege at Beslan. Now, if anybody can explain what the correlation is between appointing regional governors and fighting the war on terror, you know, it's kind of anybody's guess what that link is. But it's very reminiscent of the Patriot Act being rammed through and various other, you know, regulatory and executive order steps being taken by the Bush administration in the days and weeks after 9/11. You know, using the cover of a nation, you know, reeling from a fairly horrific tragedy, in order to take what was essentially a pre-existing plan for something that was ideologically desired all along by the leadership and putting it into practice. And this is what's been going on with Putin and Russia as well. This is something that was already gathering dust on somebody's shelf. It was clearly not invented in the 10 days between the end of the school siege and when it was announced at the beginning of this week.
All right. And moving along over to Iran, and the U.S. had a setback there.
Yeah, the IAEA,
the International Atomic Energy Agency,
the agency that is charged with non-proliferation under the United Nations, has decided not to refer to the UN Security Council the case against Iran, which is something that the United States has very much desired, and which Britain and France and Germany had very much opposed. As well as third world countries that very much opposed the U.S. has been trying to make the case that Iran is developing its nuclear program for nuclear weapons as well as for nuclear energy, and the core of their case being that Iran had not revealed until 2 years ago, when some dissidents revealed that they had been continuing to develop their nuclear energy program on the black market. The IAEA has essentially said, and it's a vote that I believe will take place today, but the draft is already pretty much set. The IAEA basically has said that its questions have been answered, more or less, regarding that there are a few loose ends to tie up, but basically that they're satisfied that Iran is in fact developing this for energy purposes as opposed to for nuclear weapons. And the U.S. is very much adamantly opposed to this. Of course, you know, there's only a little bit of hypocrisy there, since we don't apply nearly that kind of pressure to Pakistan, which is not only a country that is a nuclear power on its own, but which was the source of the illicit nuclear materials, or one of the sources of the illicit nuclear materials for Iran and for a number of other countries over the past number of years.
I think what's really interesting about this whole case is that you had China and Pakistan and some other non-aligned nations in the third world saying, look, they were making the point, look, it's not banned under the non-proliferation agreement.
The use for energy is not banned.
To enrich uranium for peaceful purposes. What that stance is saying, when these countries that have so much invested in actually going along with the U.S. line and in order to get preferential treatment for trade purposes and for loans with the IMF and the World Bank, et cetera, when these countries stand up and make such a strong statement against the U.S. position, what they're actually saying is that the members of the third world are viewing the peaceful use of nuclear energy as a way to catch up with the West economically and developmentally. And I think there's some interesting things going on there that you have to look at philosophically, that do we really want that to be the main tool the third world uses in order to catch up with us developmentally? And secondly, do they need to have the things that we have that are not so great for the environment? You know, do they need to have sport utility vehicles? Do they need to go our what I would say our mistaken route for enriching, you know, the human race? Do we need to live that way? And I think also, do we need as the human race to use a form of energy that to replace what is, you know, the burning of oil and coal, what is a very, very bad thing for the environment? Do we need to replace it with something that is also equally dangerous and bad for the environment, just in a different way, as well as something that also opens up the door to the use of this tool as a very dangerous weapon? Because, of course, when you enrich uranium for peaceful purposes, you can also turn it around to make weapons. Now, I don't totally agree that Iran is doing this for peaceful purposes. After all, they are a major producer of oil and certainly produce enough oil for their domestic uses. I think they're also doing it so that they can have the nuclear arsenal that the Bush administration is saying. I think that is a real concern here.
Yeah.
But I think
a deterrent at any rate.
Yeah, yeah. At least as a deterrent against U.S. aggression. Now, I think that the U.S. is arguing from a very weak standpoint when they single out nations like Iran and North Korea and say, no, you cannot enrich uranium, even though you've been taking steps to do it all along. And then they don't point the finger at Pakistan and say, look, you cannot enrich uranium. In fact, nobody should be able to enrich uranium. I think that's a stronger standpoint than the one that the Bush administration is saying, well, only our friends can do it. Not our enemies.
Yeah, and I think there's even a larger question when you mentioned, well, you know, is this the way that third world countries can catch up to the United States? Is it even a desirable goal environmentally for third world countries to catch up to the United States, or is it more the case that the United States needs to ramp back on our consumption, on our materialism? Mm-hmm. For the future of the planet. I mean, that's really, I think, more the...
And we should point out that the Bush administration has been doing nothing, absolutely nothing, to look at alternatives and has, in fact, been talking about promoting the use of nuclear energy.
And not only that, but has also been extremely hostile toward non-proliferation regimens in the UN and other agencies.
Except when it forwards the U.S.'s goals of, say, targeting Iran and North Korea specifically.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is very, very inconsistent and really undermines the U.S.'s goal of stopping Iran and North Korea when you only apply it to those nations.
And these sorts of inconsistencies and hypocrisies are things that are seen and resented by other countries very clearly.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of nuclear weapons and proliferation, they also had an article this week where the Navy is transferring two more Trident submarines over to the Bangor base coming soon to a base near you.
Let's give them a big welcoming party.
which will finally make us, you know, the port
with
the largest fleet, the largest Trident fleet in the world, and we'll have the most nuclear weapons in the world just 15 miles from us right now.
So that makes me feel so safe,
doesn't it?
Maybe you.
I think a little armada of a little inflatable rubber dinghies in Puget Sound should be around to welcome them when they sail in.
Well, I can tell you, I was out there when the Seafair fleet came in this year on a rubber raft, and I can tell you want to be in something a little bit bigger, because it still hurts to sit down. So. All right. Well, looks like that leaves us with one thing left, and that's This Week in Iraq.
Yeah, this was the week when the mainstream media suddenly and surprisingly discovered that the U.S. is losing the war in Iraq.
And no!
I just want to say, what took them so long? No, it was interesting. There were articles in the New York Times and Washington Post and the Los Angeles Times, and then even the weekly news magazines picked it up, Newsweek and Time and the big journals like Foreign Affairs magazine. They all had articles with titles like "It's Worse Than You Think" and "What Went Wrong in Iraq," and it's comical, you know, for me at least, because I've been talking about Iraq for over a year now and all of the mistakes that have happened along the way, and it really, looking back on that, it really, really is obvious that we lost the war from the day we invaded.
We lost the war as soon as it was clear that Iraqi civilians were not throwing rose petals at the feet of the invading soldiers.
Yeah, when the Shiites did not agree with us, when the very first thing that happened after U.S. troops would go into a city is that the looting started up, I mean, that was very clear when you saw from the first few days that the Iraqi government ministries, that public works projects, everything was being dismantled and taken home and sold on the black market.
And you could even see this in the cities in southern Iraq long before we got to Baghdad. I mean, you could see it in the initial reaction in southern Iraq when soldiers came into those cities. It was very clear that the Bush administration's narrative of this is how we will be received, this is what will happen in post-war Iraq, was a neocon fantasy, that it had no basis in reality, and that things were going to go very, very differently. And it's a shame that it's taken a year and a half and so many lives to get to this point where people are just now recognizing that some of the mistakes that have been made.
And I just want to ask, you know, where was the media when some of these things happened, like when the Coalition Provisional Authority moved into one of Saddam Hussein's old palaces in Baghdad and set up a fortress in the Green Zone? Where was the U.S. media to critique that? Where was the U.S. media when the U.S. troops opened fire on demonstrators in Fallujah a year ago and started up what would be the insurgency? When Iraqis saw that, well, if we demonstrate peacefully, we get killed, so the only way we can demonstrate is with weapons in our hands. Where was the U.S. media then? And where was the U.S. media when you had the sacking of the Baathists, the whole Baathist chain of command and the whole military in Iraq, after the Bush administration had said, well, we will go in and just take out the top guys and everything else will remain in place and we will have the whole Iraqi military to help us keep the peace in Iraq? Where was the U.S. media critiquing that move? You know, where was the U.S. media during the invasion of Najaf? The destruction of the old city of Najaf, the holiest city in the Shiite world. You know, where was the U.S. media to critique that and say, this is wrong, this is bad? You know, where were they when the U.S. bombed mosques in Fallujah? Where were they with the Abu Ghraib scandal? How could the U.S. media assume, after the photos of Iraqi prisoner abuse were released for the whole world to see, how could the U.S. media go on and swallow the Bush administration assurances that we can salvage the situation in Iraq, they want to work with us, et cetera, et cetera? I just can't see it.
And those are just a few of the examples. The examples are just endless.
The examples are endless. It is true. So, and I thought it was kind of interesting. So we had this big media, you know, brouhaha over Kofi Annan's remarks, the UN Secretary General's remarks that the war in Iraq is illegal under international law. Suddenly that became a big sort of scandal.
This week.
Yeah, this week. I mean, Kofi Annan's been saying that for over a year now. He's been saying exactly the same thing for months on end. So where's the U.S. media been? I mean, it's like suddenly somebody hit him with a shock stick and said, "Wake up," you know, and they're waking up and covering this.
And the question, of course, is how long they'll continue to cover this, or whether they'll say, "Now that we've said it once, we don't have to say it again."
Yeah, and I think the question is why now? Why are they covering it now? I think there's an answer to that, and the answer to that is the statistics are finally coming out and what's happened in the last 2 to 3 months, that U.S. deaths have finally hit the 1,000 mark. We've got 3 U.S. soldiers dying every day. These last 2 weeks, more than 50 U.S. troops have died just in the last 2-week period. I think, and the fact that overall attacks against U.S. troops have gone from, you know, the level of 40 to 50 a day back in January when we last really looked at it, to more than 80 a day just in the last 2 months. I think that's really, I also want to mention here that the nature of guerrilla attacks against U.S. troops have changed dramatically. In the past year, it's been roadside bombings, sabotage attacks, nighttime mortar attacks on U.S. bases. That has changed radically. I mean, those are still occurring, but what we're seeing now is U.S. troops coming into hospitals with bullet holes in them. Not with shrapnel injuries, not from roadside bombings anymore, or mortar attacks, but they're being shot at by guerrillas. Now that is signifying that much of the conflict now is becoming running gun battles, and that's a sign that the guerrilla army is really becoming more cohesive and taking
a
more aggressive tact against U.S. troops in places like, and it's happening in places like Mosul and Basra and Baghdad. And I think any media outlet that has any people in Baghdad can see immediately that the capital city itself, there are large portions of the capital city that neither the U.S. Military authority or the Iraqi government control. Large portions of the capital city, and it's so difficult for reporters to get out of the green zone itself, not just into the capital city, but anywhere in Iraq, that they're finally saying, this looks a lot like Vietnam.
Yeah,
you know?
I would say before I get too far off of it, there's one other reason that that media is just now coming to the conclusion that we're losing the war in Iraq and saying so. I agree that the statistics play a major role, but I think also you're seeing some of the polling data now showing that the way the Iraq war is going is not hurting George Bush politically. I think that's giving media a little bit of wiggle room to say, I think the perception has been there before that if we report what's actually going on in Iraq, it will be seen as partisan, it will be seen as favorable to John Kerry, and that's made media more reluctant to do that, I think.
And it shouldn't.
You would hope that media would simply report something that's happening because it's happening and because it's important.
But it is.
So that makes the word election another factor here.
Yeah, very much
right.
So.
And they are continuing, though, to pull their punches on reporting in Iraq.
Very much so.
I mean, we see a little bit of reporting, but we don't see the continuous reporting. Yes, the U.S. is continuing to bomb civilian targets in Fallujah and villages south of Fallujah and continuing to kill civilians in places like Tal Afar and Mosul, et cetera. Now, it's not clear that the Iraqi government is even going to survive, much less hold elections next year, but the U.S. press is still continuing to report the Bush administration assurances and Iraqi government assurances that yes, 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 we will get things under control and there will be elections on time.
Yeah, we saw that as a tangent in Afghanistan this week also with another attempt on Karzai's life. And
Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan.
And the assumption that elections are going to go ahead there and be legitimate next month.
And there may not even be a candidate to elect if Hamid Karzai is killed.
Yeah. Because
so,
they don't have any way to get another one.
And they don't have any other candidates running against him that are able to campaign, although he's not particularly able to campaign either, since, as you can see, whenever he goes outside the city of Iraq, or city of
Kabul,
he becomes a target.
Yeah.
Now, there's another thing I want to mention, one other topic I want to mention here, talking about Iraq. The Bush administration, it will have to go to Congress for funds to be transferred from Iraq reconstruction to security. They're asking for $3.5 billion of the $18 billion set aside for reconstruction. Now, that money is going to come out of water and sewer projects. We'll lose something like $1.9 billion. Electricity reconstruction projects will lose $830 million. And now where that money is going to go, only $1.8 billion of the $3.5 billion will go to hire and train about 45,000 Iraqi police and about 16,000 National Guard troops and then a few thousand border guards. That's simply a drop in the bucket of what's needed. The rest of the money is going to go for projects that don't really fall under the security headline. The biggest chunk will be $380 million for unspecified economic developments, and get this, $360 million to forgive U.S. debt for Iraq. That means that money's going to go to pay off banks, U.S. banks that made bad investments by giving loans to Iraq.
All right, well, maybe we can go into some more detail on some of those numbers next week. Unfortunately, we are out of time, talking once again with Joff Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And tell people quickly where they can find Eat the State.
Eat the State comes out every other week. It's a free newspaper that you get places where you find free periodicals at bookstores and cafes and places like that. We're also on the web at www.eatthestate.com. www.lifeonthepage.org with our current and all our back issues and local and global topics and all that good stuff. And if you want to volunteer, that's what the rest of us all do. Or if you want to, if you have story tips or feedback on things you hear on this program, ideas, donations, any of that, give us a call. Our voicemail is area code 206-903-9461.